4 months ago, October 1981, Dr. Randolph Nugent was elected General Secretary of the Board of Global Ministries of the United Methodist Church. Now, that's the recent past. I'd like to ask you to go back with me 25 years ago to the spring semester, 1957. Randy Nugent, a young New Yorker, teaching high school that semester, was also completing his M.A. in English at Hunter College. He had also applied to the Board of Missions of the Methodist Church for work overseas. That interest in the world church had been nurtured by several people who had been influential in his life, by his involvement in the student Christian movement and through other forces. It all came to a head in June of 57. The Board of Missions said to the young Mr. Nugent, "We have accepted you and we are appointing you to be a teacher in Robert College, Istanbul, Turkey." Well, this was what Randy had been hoping for, but perhaps the very fact of the appointment caused him to search within, to consider the adequacy of his own understanding of the Christian faith and his ability to articulate it in life and in word in a community predominantly Muslim. The thought suddenly came to him that perhaps it would be wiser to stay here and find his ministry here and pursue the understanding of the Christian faith further. And so he asked the Board of Missions, after some profound and painful searching, to withdraw his name from that appointment, and they agreed to do so. He applied to Drew Theological Seminary, entered there in the fall of 57. Was in seminary 57 to 60. But he went to Drew determined to fulfill his mission in ministry and to pursue his ministry as a seminary student pastor. There are some interesting connections, and I think if you even hear that comment, you will immediately begin to discern what I'm going to say. Also in the spring semester of 57, young Jim Kirby was graduated here at Perkins with his B.D. degree. And he went on and took the STM, and then in the fall of 59, went to Drew to pursue the doctoral work. Of course, that was Randy Nugent's final year in seminary. That 59-60 year was a year of overlap for Jim Kirby and Randy Nugent at Drew. And then, as things sometimes unfold, lo and behold, Jim Kirby, several years ago, went to Drew as dean. And in that post, he was able to welcome Randy Nugent to the board of directors of Drew Theological Seminary. And I think it rather delightful that as things have worked out, Randy Nugent is able to be here for this minister's week when we are installing Jim Kirby and to share and participate in the joy that we feel in this occasion. Meanwhile, back to 1960. The young seminary graduate, determined to pursue mission in ministry, was appointed to an inner-city parish in Albany. And the folk in New York with concerns for such things kept their eyes on him, and in 5 years' time, in 65, they said, "He is the man to launch and direct our new program of metropolitan urban service training for young men and women going into inner-city parishes." He conducted that work for 5 years. And then, and always with the vision of the totality of Christ's world mission before him, he was called at the age of 36 by the National Council of Churches to head the Division of Overseas Ministries. And he served in that post for 2 years, and then was called by his own church to become Associate General Secretary of the National Division within the Board of Global Ministries. In a sense, we might say he served that post through the decade of the 70s, literally from 72 until the fall of 81. Many noteworthy developments, but I would point only to one. Dr. Nugent helped the National Division to encourage the United Methodist Church to launch the program of ethnic minority ministries. He has kept the vision of the total mission before him. He knows that in order for it to be universal, it must also be effectively local, a theme which Victor Furnish has emphasized with us. To be universal, it must be effectively local, with each embodiment of the church universal, showing forth in its life the meaning of the cross and of the resurrection. And so it is that we come to our second Fondren lecture, The Mission and the Church. I am pleased to present Dr. Randolph Nugent.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hogg. I don't believe that yesterday when I began, I was sufficiently conscious of gratitude, or at least I wasn't expressing it in that way, for those who have made it possible for me to be with you in this lectureship. I've heard a lot about Perkins and SMU, and being here this week has helped to fill and fulfill some of the expectations and hopes and experiences of which I have heard, so for that I'm most grateful. I take myself too seriously after the introduction, I have to begin in another way. I wasn't sure I'd begin this way, but this is clear evidence that I should, with a story, which, of course, I hope will lead into what I'll say, and if it doesn't, I'll find a way to do it. But it was a story about a man who rushed from church appointment to church appointment. And he was going in a very mountainous area when his car broke down. Felt he had to get to where he was going, so he waited, and there was nothing in sight. And then around the corner came a man on a donkey. Now listen, the car was broken down, and he felt that this appointment was most appropriate, so he made an agreement to purchase the donkey and got on it, but it wouldn't move. Well, he said to the man, "Tell me, how does this donkey go?" The man said, "Well, it's rather easy. You want this donkey to go, you have to say, 'Thank God.' This donkey moves only when you say that." I said, "Fine, okay, how do you make it stop?" He said, "Well, all you have to do is say, 'Amen.'" He got on the donkey. He was going rather slowly, and the man was really in a hurry to get to this very important appointment. So he said, "Oh, I know what to do with this donkey. I'll just say, 'Thank God, thank God,' and he'll go faster." And sure enough, he said, "Thank God, thank God, thank God." And this donkey really began to go into a fast trot. Well, it was rather mountainous, you recall. Came around the curve, and here seemed to be a cliff, a drop-off. And he said, "How do I make this animal stop?" And, "Oh," he said, "I remember. Amen." The donkey stopped right at the end. The man said, "Thank God." Today, wherever one is in mission, we must be clear that mission has not fallen off the track or not fallen over a cliff. Whether it is in an international arena or a national situation or even within a local community, the places in which we are privileged to labor and to love will be characterized, if we are going to be in mission today, by a sense of nationalism or unity or identity having to do with the locale and what the local people think is best for them. There will be in those places a sense of anti-colonialism and anti-adventurism, a sense of privatization, and to some degree, apathy toward those who would be in mission, and if not apathy, to some degree, downright hostility, at least on a national level. People in this day, it is said, want to have something to say about their own destiny, and they have little truck for those who come from without, it would seem, to help to shape their destiny. It is not likely, then, in many places that you will find a welcome if you are deeply concerned about being in mission. Now, that is not to say that the outsider-insider syndrome will become operative, but it does point to the need for a greater sense of participation in mission on the part of those to whom and with whom we are to be in mission. So thus, I think it should be clear to us that while the content of mission might remain the same, the God who offers love and grace remain the same, the setting, the context, the political situations of today differ, both within the nations and communities into which we are to be in mission, and from the nations and the churches and the communities which extend themselves significantly toward others. There can be little comparison between mission as it was known in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, that which is required of our churches today. The mission arena is far more diverse. And persons who are willing to participate in mission and who are called from our churches are from a broad arena of competencies and groups and perspectives and understandings. The places in which we are called to labor cannot be understood as being passive, awaiting for our word. People today are active. They are concerned about the issues affecting their life. And self-determination, at least that word, is the order of the day. The community memory is longer, and there is readily available information about the people, about the persons, about the churches, and about the nations from which people come to do mission and their past record. Let me tell you a story. Our church, and I'm not sure how many of us remember, have had a long and historic relationship for mission in Algeria. We have been in ministry there for years, and our missionaries stayed and risked their lives all during the time in which that terrible Algerian war was going on, the war that you've seen in picture on television. They served, they healed, they prayed. They loved, they fed. We have a church which is there. Some time ago, there was a situation in Sudan, because in the Sudan, you may recall, there was a civil war going on. The southern part of that country is populated by black Africans, and the northern part by Arabs. I say that as a descriptive thing that we must begin to understand for what I hope will be the point. In the southern part, there have been missionaries and missions and a Christian approach to the land. It's a land which is in need. It is undeveloped. There are hardly any roads. There is not much government industry or intervention. And in the north, where Islam is the dominant religion, some of the major cities, and at that time, all of the development. And our church was involved in the development of churches and mission in that area when the war began. Now, it was a heavy political war. The Soviet Union was involved with the government in its attack on the people in the South, who were the terrorists and the guerrillas. They had a policy of scorched earth. They burned the crops and killed the animals. And the call went up for food. Our church was involved in a program of providing food for the people whom we knew as brothers and sisters in the faith, although their government knew them as terrorists and guerrillas. We had worshipped with them for years. And they said to us, "Will you feed us?" I happened to be one of those to whom the responsibility fell to work in the program. And so the food from the United States was either shipped or flown in those days to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And then it was trucked down to the border with the Sudan. And then we were met by lines of men who carried the goods, weighty, across the grasslands on their shoulders and on their heads. I suppose we were lucky because in all of those trips, we didn't meet any government persons, and it was an area that was open, only grassland. And we fed the people, and they were grateful, and they continued in their worship and in their services and in their ministry in that area. One evening, I had to leave, and I went to Geneva, Switzerland, where we were making arrangements for other churches, basically European churches, to enter into the feeding program. And I stayed at a hotel in which used to be, in its heyday, a major hotel for Americans. I mean, the significance was they would bring the Herald Tribune. That made it a major hotel for Americans. Okay? I received a telephone call in my room from a man who had an Arabic name. He said, "I want to come up to your room to talk about that feeding program." Now, let's remember, it was an illegal program as far as the government of Sudan was concerned. And your humble servant, Randolph Nugent, was very frightened because I figured it was all over. They found out. And with my heroic voice, I said, "Let me come down to the lobby." I figured, if you're going to die, you might as well die in the lobby. I mean, they'll never find me up here in this room. And when I arrived at the lobby, and by the way, this was a hotel which, it was at a time in which the Arab nations were beginning to have oil, and lots of the people were in Geneva, and you'd go down into the hotel, and there they were with their prayer beads and everything else. And the man said to me, "Listen, I'm from Algeria, the Minister of Justice." That's the equivalent to our Attorney General. He said, "I'm a Muslim, but I know what your church had been doing and did for us in Algeria. And if that is what your church did in Algeria, most certainly you must be doing the same thing here in Sudan." Now, here was a witness years before in another nation which carried over. Now, I'm going to make the story short because he said to us, "Would you mind if I talk to President Numeri of the Sudan about your feeding program? Because if you're working with people and feeding people, and that's what you did with us, and you're binding wounds, they need to know who it is who was at the other end of this program." So we said, "Fine." The word came back to us that President Numeri wanted to talk with the persons with whom he was involved, who had been involved in revolution. In his parlance, they were the terrorists and they were the guerrillas. In our parlance, they were the members of our churches and congregations in mission. And so they said to us, "Listen, we don't trust the government. They want us to come to the conference table. But will you pay for us to go? We trust you." Now, we felt that was worth mission money. We said, "Sure, it's about peace. Come on." So we walked back out of Sudan into Ethiopia, buy the plane tickets, fly back into northern Sudan. The missionaries who had been working with these persons were missionaries who concentrated, not exclusively, but fundamentally and primarily on the Bible. And they help them read the book and learn how to plumb its text. And they had a custom that they would not begin any public meeting unless there were Bible reading. And so when these persons from the Sudan got to the conference table, now in the capital of Khartoum with the Muslims, they insisted that they read their Bible first. So they sat down across the conference table ready to talk about peace, but they first had to read from Jeremiah. They discussed with these persons around the table for 4 hours the text and its meaning. Lots of things happened in the engagement. Lots of things happened because in that engagement, and after much discussion for several days and weeks, came a peace. You know, Sudan has done some interesting things, and that is all of the rebels after that conversation were given the same position they had in the rebel government, in the rebel army, now in the regular government. The church became operative in a new way in that situation. Today is not 1940, 1950. It's not the Nazi Party which threatens the economic stability and peace as it was in the 40s. Today it does not take 2 weeks to travel from the United States to Asia or Africa. Today the great confrontations are between East and West politically, and North and South economically. The map of the world with all of the continents of the globe has radically changed. Asia, Africa, Latin America, along with Central America and the Caribbean areas, are no longer the exclusive province of Western nations and the churches of the West. Mission and the sending of missionaries has become a global phenomenon. Church in Korea, for example, which is the second largest Methodist church, is sending missionaries. To some degree, in the past, the extension of the church's outreach moved at the same time as the period of economic expansionism of the West and military dominance and colonialism. You remember the open door policy? That was a time in which Protestant churches had their greatest day in mission. We know about the exploitation of minerals in the continent of Africa and Rhodes and all of his movement into that area. And you remember that Cecil Rhodes had as one of his banners the proclamation of the word and all that that meant. We are clear that, at least in Latin America, as far as this nation is concerned, the Monroe Doctrine had as its complementary effort a missionary effort into the continent. But the development of indigenous and Christian communities and the establishment of congregations within the nations on all of the continents has meant that mission today, if it is to be undertaken from within a nation, must be done in conjunction with the churches now, and in many places with the governments in those nations. The simple fact, for example, that central governments claim responsibility for detailed actions within their nation, at the remote corners of their nation, and that the changes in the ground rules brought about by those simple requirements for mission are many. For example, education of children, once the stock and trade of mission, as it brought the gospel and helped to bring a word of literacy has now got to be done in accord with national development plans. Moreover, the rapid growth of indigenous churches is also, I would suggest, related to the process of indigenization. The church in that place is no longer a mission, but it is the church. The change in the global aspect of missions raises for our churches a very important question for discussion and for review, and that is that it raises a fundamental question as to the condition and the status of the entire missionary movement. Why it is that action presently, for example, is focused or is not focused upon the global scene, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, the Mediterranean area, Asia Minor, for that matter, the Soviet Union. Certainly, one cannot suggest that the kingdom has come in England or Germany or the Scandinavian countries. Surely, Eastern Europe is not immune from the need of the gospel, and the low level of church attendance in Scandinavia is not an indication of the massive response to the gospel and to mission. The violence in England and Ireland, the continuation of terrorism in Italy, the brutalization of all humanity within the Soviet Union are evidences, I would suggest, of a need for salvation. Sometimes it is almost as if there were a formula operative in mission in which we focus entirely upon the starving children in Asia or Africa and preach only about sin within the United States. Today, I would suggest, there is a need for redefinition of the places to which we are called to be in mission. The church is at a watershed in terms of mission. The world in which we have been operative for the past 40 years, the concepts, the constructs which have shaped our thought and action concerning mission have changed. The idea, for example, that out there in the world awaits a passive, massive population to whom we might go, and in our going only present the word to them, is no longer valid. The view that the gospel from our shores is something which should be carried somewhere, usually to a culture which is less dominant than the one in which we have come, no longer holds. The ability to move at will between nations with our personnel is no longer an unlimited possibility. There must be a realization in terms of mission that once again, persons in mission may have to recognize that all of life is a mission situation, requiring persons who may be willing to spend a significant number of years in that mission, contrary to the present thought. When people move between nations and do so out of love, when there are major differences between culture of the nations from whence they come and the nations to which they move, and when one recognizes that there may not be easy acceptance of those persons, one of the other, it is clear that we can no longer view the missionary task as a temporary, short-term process, but rather one which takes quite some time to enable the love and the growth so hoped for to mature. Moreover, and this is a big moreover, wherever or when there is a disparity in economic and political systems leading to suspicion and mistrust, how much longer will the task take? And if mission in our day is to be done in places where corruption violates God's creation, or where violence snuffs out life as if it were meaningless. And inasmuch as God is calling women and men to proclaim the word in places where people from our churches are called to labor, in churches in which nations, in which, or rather I should say, in whose nations the economic systems differ greatly from our own, and in which nations the political systems are strange to our view, then the people who are called to be in mission are confronted with a very difficult task, one in which they are called not only to proclaim a word to the places in which they move, but also equally a task that we might understand when they return to our midst what it is that they have experienced. And inasmuch as mission is relating to people, it is clear that as long as people are experiencing new situations, one cannot assume that the mission is complete. To have preached in one city, in one nation, over 50 years ago, is not to assume that what has been said and what has been heard is still remembered, or that people remain the same. The repetition of the name does not necessarily mean its retention in memory. Every new life created, every new person born creates a new mission opportunity. Every change of government within a nation calls for new mission. So today, the central concern of mission is still the call of men and women to service, the service of the Lord, a calling of persons without whom, as the saying goes, no city could stand. Now, the proclamation of the gospel from our churches requires that those who speak act out of the same context and perspective. As the mission field is far more diverse than ever before, there will be a myriad of ways to engage persons in mission. Wherever there is the existence of racism, poverty, and oppression, there we need to be clearly in mission. What more powerful a symbol can there be for mission than people sharing lives and upholding justice? People expressing concern for one another that lead to restored relationships in ways which defy normal expectation. We are called to be in mission whenever and wherever human life is being degraded and people are put down from the level just below the angels. There is where we are called to speak aloud and proclaim God's love and God's hope for humankind. Now, it may seem to be unreasonable to some, but in terms of mission, there cannot be any length to which one would not go, which is called too far. The act of outgoing love must never be cut off unexpectedly, for who can tell when God might choose to act in the life of a person. So mission from our churches is the continuing act of reclaiming all of life for the God who created it, who loved it so much that all of life and even Jesus Christ might be given for it. In a world in which some human life is thought to be less valuable than other human life, those persons who are on the frontier of mission do not have the luxury to discriminate or to choose between valuable and less valuable life. The mission which we proclaim from our churches is not some theory on the boundaries of this world in places in which we are unwelcome or facing questions which we cannot answer, which suggests that we call upon the God as some hypothesis. Mission in these areas is not work on those failures and conflicts which cannot be solved or resolved, which drive the missionary in despair to call upon some transcendent hope. Mission in those places is not simply an explanation of relationship between divine and human realm. But in the places in this world of which I speak, which we are called to be in mission, mission is the reality of a God who has come into the world in Jesus Christ, and the reality of the world so loved by that God that the followers of that God love the world and make themselves available to share in that world. And that is not an easy matter. One of the most serious and difficult tasks, then, is the matter facing us concerning the manner by which we make faith relevant in an age of revolution. In place after place and situation after situation, vengeance and violence and murder and terrorism have become the order of the day. And we are called in that climate of brutality and degradation to love. The very existence of wrong, Gollwitzer said, was a bill of our neglect. Thus, I'm suggesting to you that we have an Herculean task. One, we cannot write off the movements of oppression for their brutality, for their errors in theory and on human practice. I would say almost to ourselves, it is to the shame of our missionary effort that movements of oppression find no church in the way of their actions. In many of the places in which we are to be in mission, those who would oppress found not the gospel of good news to the whole person, body and soul, especially to the humble and to the poor. Not the promise of the coming of an already risen and ruling Christ, but only the division of body from spirit, the hope of a spiritual eternal life, and the neglect or the sanctification of the material arrangements of the world. Moreover, in many such situations, when one raises questions concerning the arrangements of the status quo, there is frequently an attempt to discredit the church's concern for the outcast and for the oppressed. Tonight, for example, as I was listening to the news about El Salvador, there was a mention about President Duarte and the Roman Catholic sisters who had lost their lives. When they talked about the sisters, the news commentator said, some of them were called troublemakers. Tyranny, arbitrary or despotic exercise of power, absolute power oppressively or brutally applied, has become the norm of the day. Tyranny is a habit, and it has the capacity to develop, and it does develop, in the end, into a disease. Without the gospel, the best of persons becomes degraded by force of habit to levels of less than human. Blood and power in those situations, it seems, intoxicate. Callousness and perversity develop and grow, and the greatest perversions become acceptable and finally, in the minds of many who operate at those levels, sweet to the mind and to the heart. We are those who watch with Christ in Gethsemane. And we are called to share our being with others, even unto death. Thus in our day, the day in which power is exercised through enormous economic systems whose focus is often the maintenance of power and the accumulation of wealth at any cost, mission to persons and to systems is still required. It is good to respond to individual need so that persons may be always reminded of the response of mission to personal need, but also in a day in which the weight is on the side of totalitarian and authoritarian governments or other state powers, be they left or revolutionary organizations, a response from a missionary movement on a broad front is needed. Wherever those characteristics which uphold the qualities of life are removed or jeopardized, their mission is called for. The success of the missionary movement in this regard is seen in that today even governments speak about the rights of human beings. But we need to be reminded that governments have a tendency to want to be selective in their application to the principle of upholding life. Jesus showed us, however, what it meant to be a person for others. For he was powerless and he was a servant who suffered because he carried our sins. And those who are in mission are to carry the power of powerlessness to transform a world in which people and systems, it would seem, have become crazed by the quest to become the most powerful. For our denomination, this call from the church is to share the being of Christ in the world, which means in the fullest sense to love the world, to be a part of it, to share its problems, its successes, its failures, its powers, and its helplessness, to know all of its melodies to the fullest as one who shares with Christ even unto death. Now there is a perspective that I think might be helpful if we understand, which follows after having introduced persons to the God whom we know. And there are some characteristics which may help us to understand the new missionary situation with which we are confronted. Let me share them with you. First perspective is this. We are having to work in a world and in places in which there is or has been the emergence of a highly developed political consciousness on the part of many groups in places in which we are called to be. There is a view that each nation, and to some degree, every community within that nation, has the right to govern itself and determine its own course of action. When we are present to proclaim the word, we must not confuse that word with any political perspective. Those who speak a word from a political viewpoint may use the words that they hear the church use, but we must never, those of us in mission, become confused between the one whom we are to represent and those who govern. Number two. There is a social dynamism and determination out there in the world to create a new social order. A social dynamism which in our day seems to be a dynamism which has come from the poor. There is a groundswell of people who are poor, a global phenomenon, not yet linked around the globe, but global nevertheless. in which one can see here and there the perspective which says people who are poor want to change their status and to improve their status, if that is at all possible. Number three, there is a view that in some parts of the world, that the present world economy is one which breeds poverty. And we will have, those of us who are to be in mission or who are supportive of mission, will have to be in a world in which nation after nation will experiment with a variety of economic systems. We must never, never confuse the good news with any of those economic systems. Number four, there is extant a sense of group identity and far less individualism than has been thought to be traditional in Europe and North America. The gospel, when it concerns itself for all persons, must, in its serving aspects, issue and proclaim a word to a broad network of people. Number five, there is out there in that world where we are in mission, attempts to develop communal forms of organization. Truly, there seems to be an effort to relate to, there must be an effort to relate to the needs of many. The ability of individuals to respond should not negate on our part the ability of responsiveness to groups of persons. Number six, there is, or there has become, a drive to equalize the highly valued private satisfactions which we have come to know with concern for the entire community. Number seven, there is a high value for personal relationships. Impersonal efforts are not effective and no longer acceptable. And number eight, there is a view that modernization can and should be used for all of the people. Now, if that is what is happening in the world where we ought to be in mission in a sort of encapsulated way, that raises for those of us who are from our churches wanting to be in mission some certain specific problems. Let me share those with you. The first is a problem of simply, I will call, historiography. Now, the reason I use that word is I was told that when you come to Perkins, every now and again, you have to throw in some kind of a million-dollar word. It's my million-dollar word for the week, historiography. What we're talking about here is the understanding of the events, the experiences, the effects, and the relationship of those effects to the causes. In developing communities around the world and in neighborhoods, there is an immediate problem that everyone has when they are talking about the development of their communities in terms of understanding what is taking place in the community so that the mission and the ministry which is undertaken may be effective. There is within developing communities to some degree a lack of communication. What, for example, is the difference in a developing community between liberation and what we outside of that community would understand to be a terrorist group? See, that's the kind of discussion which we can engage in. But within the construct of that particular community, it becomes a different kind of debate and understanding. But it's critical that we understand the problem of recognizing what is taking place within that community. We who stand outside of revolutionary communities have a different problem. And that is, we must always remain steady in terms of the faithfulness of the local Christian community. In a revolutionary world, I would suggest there is required added commitment to one another, lest we lose faith that the God who has chosen us and made us and formed us has made the wrong choice. There was a school that was in the midst of a revolutionary situation. The war had not yet subsided. Many of the young people in the school had left and gone to join the struggle. It is related to our denomination. And they were having a graduation. And so I went to see what graduation could be like in a revolutionary situation. The young people lined up to march into the auditorium for the graduation. And before they moved, one of the students said, "Let us pray." And so I listened with intent. And there from the student's lips was uttered a word of thankfulness for all of the people in the United States who had made that education possible for them. We must hold steady where there is revolution and believe that our people will remain faithful to the God who has called them. Second kind of problem. In an age in which pluralism has become the dominant style for the future, what will be the pluralistic form of life among Christians, particularly as we engage them in mission? Number three, the problem of communication and verification and validation of the values upon which we act. I was in the mission group this afternoon, and we were discussing a particular situation, and the way in which this problem was addressed was, we don't know what is going on in a particular place. It was not a question of whether the resources had been used faithfully or whether the stewardship had been carried out, but we have no word. We are interested in and excited about the manner by which our help makes the gospel take hold, if we can say it in that way, in a particular place. How does one recognize the assumptions upon which others proceed? Number four, it's simply what I would call the situation of heredity as opposed to the acquired traits and functions. This is a problem having to do with the necessity to define the categories that are basic and necessary for life, and those which are not central and can be changed and can be negotiated. Another way of talking about this is the problem between the acquirers and the claimants, or who gets what. It's a very important intellectual problem. And now, for mission, these mean some practical problems. That is, what we will do together with our churches, between the church here and the church in that place. If we are called to enable persons to realize their full potential, to live out of the context of which God has made it possible for them to live, then we must be concerned in a practical way about problems of their survival, their physical, and their mental health. That is the first practical concern. Secondly, the matter of labor and leisure. How one spends one's time. Does one spend one's time in service voluntarily, in a compensated manner? But that's a practical problem for mission. What does one do in those places? Third practical problem for us in mission is a problem of possession. And what is at issue here is the title and the tenure and the transfer of costs. We are faced in this concern very practically with the need to be clear about the moral justification for the things that we need, the things that we use, and the things which we acquire. We are faced in this matter of possession with the problem of exploitation, the development of minerals, let's say, and resources. What does one need? And what does one acquire? Number four, practical problem in the churches. How do we help persons in those situations to organize for all that they are going to do? What will be the categories of our organization? May not sound like a major problem, but listen, if the nature of the family is somewhat different in some of those situations from ours, in the sense that it is an extended family, what will be the means by which we might organize to be of assistance? If the nature of state and community in which those churches are going to live is very different from our understanding of state and community, what shall we do? If there are no non-profit enterprises, or in fact, if there is no social service level, then by what means will we care for some of the least of that particular society? If education is controlled by the government in those places, and our churches have had the institutions to develop education, what will be our relationship with government in those places? A very practical problem, but a major problem for a missionary organization. Number five, the production problem. And here I do not mean productivity, but rather, what means of production will be most efficient? What means of production will be most efficient? And also, how will we account for the social costs that must be borne in that community? If the larger segment of the community is poor, without food, without resources, what does that say about the productive activity which will take place and the benefits of that activity? Number six, the distribution problem. How can you distribute the shares to the proper claimants? Now, there are a host of other problems. Political problems such as, what do you call upon government to assist you with in those places? What, if you are the church involved in mission, do you help other churches begin to understand is not the task of government? With knowledge that violence in humanity is a fact, and that counterviolence may produce outer order, but never inner order, our problem in a developing situation with sister churches is, how can governments avoid abusing their authority? One more practical problem. Educational. Because we cannot rely upon our instincts to tell us what to do or how to do things in mission, We're faced with the question of the same in terms of education of the whole person. What shall be the educational task of the church in those places? When we go out into the world, we are confronted with the totality of the amazing reality of salvation given by the one who gave himself. The authority which is given is not in unscarred hands, but hands pierced by nails. In going, we are called to remember the wounded hands. In going, we are called to remember that we must follow that Lord in our attempt to heal the brokenness of life. When Jesus saw illness, he empowered people. And we must, in the name and the Spirit of Jesus, help to empower people. To create those places where people may find themselves and test their newfound strength. It is mandatory that if we are going to be in mission with other churches that we adopt a style of life in the helpful perspective of transformation. We have to be the ones who are involved with our fellow churches in changing things, for God is pulling us into the future as the power of that future. And our concern for mission and evangelism in that regard is a thrust of promise and of transformation. We must always avoid despair. We must never lose hope. For the gospel approach and mission opens up a whole new horizon of expectancy and hope. It is that the good news of release from all of that which keeps humanity bound and which takes away its future. The perspective and promise of mission and the churches is in not believing your eyes, but trusting your ears, what we have heard. Mission, then, is waiting for the confrontation of witness with apathy. And no price is too great to pay for these performances when one keeps in mind the problems with which we will be confronted of the missionary task. We have heard the proclamation, and we must recognize that in the future, from our churches, mission is everywhere. Thank you.